Thank you, Larry. And good morning, friends. My name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. All right. And I, too, want to thank Vivian and Dwight and the other members of the committee for making it possible for Betsy and myself to be here for this conference, because, of course, for me, it's coming home. I was born and raised in Kansas City and Lawrence, and I'm married to a gal from Salina, so what a privilege it is to be here this weekend. And I just hope that all of you, this is my earnest hope for all of you, that you have had half as good a time as we have had so far in this convention. I've had such a thrill. I mean, I've seen so many old friends here, like, you know, Larry and Ken, and I can't name them all. And I have the thrill this morning of having right down here on the front row and the second row a whole bunch of non-alcoholics who are the members of our family who have come to hear me speak this morning. And I tell you, it's easy to talk to alcoholics, but I'm not so sure about it. It's like a family reunion down here. And then there are, as a little pocket of my relatives from Salina and Lawrence, some of them I've not really known very well before, until, by golly, on Friday night they turn up here in AA. And I tell you, sharing with them has just been one of the most heartwarming things that's ever happened to me this weekend. God bless you for coming down. And the speakers, of course, I certainly thank Dwight and Vivian and whoever put the program together for putting together a program of nothing but my friends. George, that spoke to you on Friday night, he and I served together on the Board of Trustees of Alcoholics Anonymous way back in the 60s. And, you know, he just gives you such a solid old-time AA program talk. Just great. And, of course, having Bob Smith here, I could just listen to him all day. The idea that somebody who was actually present when our co-founders, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, met for the first time, is sitting here with us having coffee and meals, is just unbelievable. It just absolutely blows my mind. And of course, Eve Marsh is a dear old friend back from the General Service Office, as she calls it, the heart, close to the heartbeat of AA. I think that slogan's been preempted by somebody else here recently on TV. But anyway, it was great hearing her. And of course, we just, Betsy, my wife, who doesn't normally, she has a very merry personality, but she doesn't laugh out loud very much. Last night, she was nearly rolling on the floor at Julian. And so it's just been a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And especially because all of you are here. I have seldom experienced a more enthusiastic AA audience than this one. You're absolutely wonderful. Because of kind of the historic angle that we have been talking about some of the time this weekend, because Bob S. is here, and because this is Sunday morning and we're supposed to have a spiritual meeting, really, it might be appropriate to take just a few minutes before I start telling about how it was and what happened and what it's like now, to trace the spiritual underpinnings of our fellowship. How many of you, if I may ask, if I can see your hands, how many of you were at the International Convention celebrating the 50th anniversary in Montreal? Oh, that's great. Yeah, good, good, good. Well, I apologize to all of you, because what I'm going to do, of course, is say just about what I said on Friday night as we opened that convention at the Olympic Stadium in Montreal. And that is that although we arbitrarily trace the founding of AA from the meeting of Bill and Dr. Bob out in Akron in 1935, when Bill himself was asked about the beginnings of AA, he liked to trace it back a few years earlier than that to the study of the great Dr. Carl Jung over in Zurich, Switzerland. And on this particular occasion, Dr. Jung had called into his study one of his patients who had been there for about a year, a young man named Roland Hazard. And Roland was the scion of a well-to-do family here in the United States, but he was a terrible drunk and a disgrace to the family, and so they had had him off at the various cures of that particular time, and of course without any success. And so having the means to do so, they had sent him all the way across the ocean and by boat in those days to be in the care of the greatest physician in the world at that time, and that was the great psychiatrist, Dr. Carl Jung. Well, Dr. Jung was saying to Roland on this particular morning, he said, we've tried for the last year to bring about some deep-seated psychological and emotional changes in you, and we really haven't had any success, and so we're going to discharge you. And Roland was, of course, I'm sure, startled at this, and he said, in effect, well then, is there no hope? And Dr. Jung replied, none. Except, he said, we do know that some people have been able to recover from alcoholism if they have been able to have a transforming experience of the Spirit. And Roland said, well, how do I bring that about? Where can I find that? And Dr. Jung, of course, said, I don't know. And so Roland left, and he went back to drinking, and he came back to the United States, and somehow, and we don't know how, he got connected up with a religious movement of the time, which was called the Oxford Groups. And these people were, as Bob was saying the other day, and thank you for those personal insights into the early Oxford Groups, Bob. They were, as he said, pursuing the values of early Christianity, and they followed certain spiritual principles, which included surrendering their wills to God and praying a lot and asking for God's direction in their lives and freely confessing their faults to one another and making amends or restitution to people that they had harmed and trying to help their fellow man. And by following these principles, apparently Roland was able to have a transforming spiritual experience take over in his life because he quit drinking. Now, by another one of these incredible coincidences that we have in AA, he was on vacation up in Vermont during this time. And it just happened by coincidence that it was on a weekend when a childhood buddy of his had gotten into a drunken driving accident, which consisted of driving a car across somebody's lawn through the front partition of the house and into the living room. Roland was able to go to the judge, whom he knew, and to tell him of his own recovery and ask if the judge would parole this Ebby, for that was his name, this Ebby into his care, and that's what happened. And so Roland and Ebby went back to New York, and they went to the Oxford, Ebby went to the Oxford Groups, and somehow he had a transforming experience of the Spirit, and he quit drinking. And in an attempt to follow the principles of the helping your fellow man, his mind went back to a drinking buddy of his, who was named Bill Wilson. And Bill was, he had been a wonder boy of Wall Street, of course, and at that moment he was sitting over in his kitchen in Brooklyn Heights. He had drunk himself out of his career. He had nearly drunk himself out of his marriage because his good wife was clerking in Macy's to keep body and soul together. He was stupefied and hopeless and absolutely at the end of his rope. And that's the way that Ebbie found him. And Ebbie tried to tell Bill what had happened to him. Very unlikely in the case of this drunken little guy. And Bill, being an unbeliever, he was not buying any of this God stuff. And so he was doomed to go out and have another horrendous binge, which ended him up in a drying out hospital of the time, not his first time there, I might add. And Ebbie called on him there, and he repeated his message that we could recover if we were able to have a transforming experience of the Spirit. And after Ebbie left, Bill, at absolute depths of despair, he called out to this God that he didn't believe in, and he had an instantaneous spiritual experience, and he never drank again. Now, of course, after that, he tried to sober up all the drunks in New York without any success, dragging them off the bar stools and out of the gutters and out of the missions and the Bowery. And nobody was listening, and he, in an attempt to regain his life, he found himself out in Akron on a proxy fight, and you heard from Bob the other day what happened out there. But when Bill and Dr. Bob met in the gatehouse of the Cyberling estate, for one thing, Bill was not trying to preach to him. Bill was going to him, to Dr. Bob, for sharing with another alcoholic in the hopes that he himself could stay sober at that point. But he also carried the message that he had received from Ebbie, who had received it from Roland, who had received it from Dr. Young. And that message, and this is what is amazing to me, that message survives in that the end of that How It Works, which was read this morning and is read thousands and thousands of times every day. You and I have heard it till we can recite it by heart. But listen, if you will, to see, to be, and see. That probably, this is Dr. Young, you see, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And see, God could and would if he were sought. Now, in my job at the General Service Office, your General Service Office, and, you know, making talks a lot, working with alcoholics over many, many years, I've talked a lot about carrying the message. I mean, we all talk about a lot about carrying the message. You know, it's in the 12th step. And I'll be absolutely honest with you. Until about 2 years ago, when all this sort of came together, I didn't really know what the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I'll bet if you asked 1,000 people, you'd get 1,000 different answers. I mean, the message that I hear a lot recently is don't drink and go to meetings. I heard from my own sponsor the message, if you want to drink, eat something sweet. Of course, I think we would all agree that the message that we carry to the alcoholic who still suffers is our own experience and strength and hope. But I'm sure that the message that was carried by Dr. Bob, by Bill to Dr. Bob, and really the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is that God could and would if he were sought. Now, when I'd been in AA for about 6 months, I went to a meeting where I heard an old-timer say something that changed my way of looking at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd like to share it with you because it may be similarly useful to you. And what this old-timer said was, AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. Now, at that point in my life, I must say that that got my attention, because I sure thought that that's what I had been doing for about 6 months, was learning how to handle my drinking. But he said, no, he said, we all know that the way to handle our drinking is to quit if we're alcoholics. But if We don't know that. There's always a lot of people around us who are trying to tell us that. He said that, he said we've all quit drinking. Alcoholics, they quit when they're in jail or when they're in hospitals or when they go on a pledge or they quit for Lent or they're quitting every once in a while. But the trick is not to quit drinking. The trick, you see, is to stay stopped. And that's what I could never do. And I immediately identified with this. At one time in my life, I had quit drinking at the very worst part of my alcoholism. I had quit for 10 months, proving, of course, that I was not an alcoholic. I had to go back to drinking. So what this man said, he said, AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. AA teaches us how to handle sobriety. And that's what none of us could handle in the first place, and that's why we drank. I mean, it's so simple. It just was lit a bulb in my head when he said that. And I found that so useful in talking to non-alcoholics ever since, who will say to me, you know, you haven't had a drink in X number of years, and still you're going to those meetings. So you're not an alcoholic. Why do you have to go to those meetings? And, you know, it's a fair question coming from somebody in the outside world, and it's a little hard to answer, unless you fall back on what I was just saying. Because it is true, I don't have a drinking problem. I haven't had a drinking problem for nearly 26 years. And I'm not going to have. I'm not going to have a drinking problem as long as I don't drink. And I won't drink as long as I stay away from a drink one day at a time and keep going to meetings. What I do have is the problem of coping with life every day sober without the help of booze to help me along, because I depended on it to do absolutely everything. But when that's cut off, you've still got to cope with life every cotton-picking day. And, of course, that's what we've all been sharing here this weekend, and it's what we share at all of our AA meetings. And that's what really makes AA so enduring and so beautiful. Now, as I say, I was born and raised right here, and there was nothing particularly unusual about my youth, except that this was back in the Depression years and before. And my father had a kind of a tough time making a living in those days, and so we moved around an awful lot. We moved actually 18 times in my first 13 years of life. And that meant that I went to Gladstone School, and I went to Mackachack School, and I went to some one-room schoolhouse over on the way out on the Kansas side. At each place that I would go, I don't know whether you men in the audience have had this experience, but you know, you go into a new school, and if you're the new kid, why, the boys that are there, they sort of test you, which basically means beating you up. And so, about the time, I literally can remember over here going down one side of a street when the other boys were on the other side of the street, because, you know, I knew they'd throw rocks at me or beat me up or something if I was over there with them. And so you'd feel kind of rejected and kind of lonely and kind of out of it. I was an only child, and I was kind of skinny and shy and introverted anyhow. So about the time that I would come out of my shell enough to make some friends, you know, two or three real good friends, and poor Dad would pull up stakes, and we'd move on to some other place, and I would repeat it all over again. Well, I tell you this only because what it did, I think, in retrospect, is that it made me kind of retreat into a fantasy world of my own. I was a daydreamer. I solved all my problems of those times by kind of living a different life in my imagination. Part of that was that I read an awful lot, and I identified with whatever I was reading about. And especially, I
went to movies.
God, I saw every movie that was made in those days. All by myself, I would be sitting in the matinee in the Dickinson Theater up in Lawrence or the Plaza Theater down here, and I would be watching whatever was on the screen, and boy, I was living that life up there. You know, if it was a war movie, boy, I was leading them over the top, man, you know. If it was a cowboy movie, I was galloping over the plains with six shooters going from both hips. But the kind of movie that I really loved and that I really identified with was something like those old Fred Astaire movies with the top hat and the white tie and the tails as he would be dancing across Central Park with Ginger Rogers in his arms. And that was the way I was going to live, my friends. And as I got into high school, I went to Southwest High School over here, and as I got into high school, I decided I was going to be a writer by trade, which I was. And I went over to KU, and was at that time that I guess I had my first drink. It was down on the plaza, and it was a Tom and Jerry, and then it was another Tom and Jerry, and a whole bunch of Tom and Jerry's, and of course I got terribly drunk and ended up throwing up behind a sign out here in Waldo or somewhere, and sleeping on the grass of my friend's house, and God, sick as a dog, and swearing off the next morning, and of course by that night I was ready to try a beer again, and that's the way it went. But it was just college type of drinking. Then in the last year of college, I sold my first article to a national magazine. Now, I was 20 years old. My family all along had given me lots of strokes for doing well in school. And the only reason I did well in school was because I read a lot. And the only reason I read a lot was because I was a lonely child. But anyhow, I was a kind of an overachiever in school, and so my parents had given me this expectation that I could do anything in the world that I wanted to. And I ask you, if you're 20 years old, you've sold an article to a national magazine, that proves it, doesn't it? And so that article was picked up by the Reader's Digest, and the subject of it was kind of a controversial thing, and it became the subject of some columns by Ed Sullivan and William Allen White and people like this were writing about me, you know, me. So as soon as school let out, I beat it back to New York to live like Fred Astaire and to make my name in New York. I was going to write the great American novel or the great American play. Well, it turned out that the only job I could get writing and editing happened to be with a big company working on their company magazine. But don't knock it, you know. I had an office in Rockefeller Center, and I lived in a men's club in Manhattan in glamorous New York, and it was absolutely great. And I was thrown in with a bunch of people who were considerably older than myself. I was 21 at that time, and most of the people in the company, of course, were somewhat older than that. And it was their custom to go down after work, to go down to the mahogany bar of the English Grill and have their martinis and Manhattans. Manhattans were very big in those days. And they invited me to go down with them. And, of course, I was thrilled to death because this was right in line with the way that I pictured myself being the man about town, the bon vivant in New York City. So I became a daily drinker when I was 21, and I remained a daily drinker all the rest of my life until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there were danger signs at that time, but you don't ever pay any attention to them. Then along came World War II, and I went into the Navy. I was a gunnery officer on a destroyer escort, and we couldn't drink on shipboard, of course, but boy, we sure did make up for it ashore, and I got into my first disciplinary problems in the Navy. I remember I was dating Bessie by this time. She'd gone through KU and come back to New York, and she was making her career as an artist, and so we had met, and I would be dating her, but on at least one occasion, why, I had disgraced myself on a liberty over in the Azore Islands, and consequently when I got to New York I was in hack, as we say in the Navy, which means that I was serving time locked up in my stateroom with an armed Marine guard outside instead of being able to get off and have fun with Betsy. But with Betsy, it was in the last year of the war, and well, all of our courtship was done, you know, at the Stork Club and the Cafe Society downtown and all these glamorous places in New York. She liked to drink and I liked to drink, so that's really what we did during our courtship. And in the last year of the war, we were married. And I was still on the ship and just had a brief leave, so we went on our honeymoon over to the resort over in the Pocono Mountains. And I just want to tell you that for those 5 days, we had an iced silver bucket of champagne by the bedside day and night. And that's the way we live, right? And I had to go back to sea, and then the war was about to end. I got transferred back ashore. I want to tell you an Al-Anon story. This is really Betsy's story, but since she's not speaking this weekend, I'll spoil it, won't I, for next year, but oh, the hell with it. Betsy's going to speak at this same conference next year, they tell me. Isn't that right? But anyway, we were transferred to Washington, D.C., where I was in the Navy Department down there, and on this particular night, we had been invited to a party that was clear across Washington, and Betsy's brother Mark was also down there in Washington at that time, so we borrowed his car, which was mistake number one, and we went clear across Washington to get to this place, and we had to go through really the toughest, worst part of Washington, and it was a very wet party. I mean, everybody got absolutely smashed, and by the wee hours of the morning, we had to come back home. And, of course, Betsy, who never really bugged me about my drinking ever, on this particular night, we'd only been married, you know, just a few months, and she had the temerity to say to me, "Now, darling, don't you think that I should drive home?" And, of course, I said, "No, I can drive." Oh, man, so I got in behind the wheel, and we drove down. We got into this very worst part of Washington. Some gink in front of me, he stopped at his stop sign, and I didn't stop, and I smashed into the rear of his car and broke the radiator, and all of the radiator fluid drained out. And the guy ahead wasn't so dumb. He just drove on. But there I was, and so I said to Betsy, "I'm going to go report this to the police." And so I left her and I went off into the night. And as she tells it, she says that she was, scared. She locked the doors of the car, and she sat there and she sat there and she sat there, and nothing was happening. So she finally decided she had to do something, and she had about 15 cents in her pocket. And so she had noticed a phone booth down the street a little bit, so she got out of the car and went down to the phone booth, and she called the police. And she said, "Have you seen a naval officer in a white uniform in there to report an automobile accident?" Well, no, they hadn't. And she said, "Well, I'd like to report the accident." And they said, "Well, was there anybody hurt?" She said, "No." And so they said, "Well, we're not really interested." So she didn't know what to do. So she only knew one other number in Washington, D.C., and that happened to be her home, our home. So she rang it. And, of course, it just rang and rang and rang and rang, and finally I answered. And when I heard her voice, I said, "Where the hell are you?" And she says that at that moment she had a little vision of what life was going to be like for the next 20 years. And so we came back to New York after the war, and I went back to work at Shell, and we eventually we had a couple of kids, and eventually had three kids, and we moved out to the suburbs, and you know, we had absolutely the greatest house you ever saw, just a lovely place. We treasure the memories of that place. A beautiful family, lovely wife and children, and I had a very good job with Shell, and everything was going for me. And you know that no alcoholic can stand that. So I drank, and I drank more and more. The old progression took over. And I began to have some troubles in my life, none of which I associated in any way with booze. But I was having trouble, for example, with lying, actually. I had been trained, if you will, to believe that a gentleman doesn't lie, a gentleman's word is his bond, and all of this kind of thing, and yet I found myself lying about almost everything. I just lied habitually to Bessie about where I'd been and what I'd been doing, and to my boss for why I was late, everything, you know. And I think it kind of disturbed me. It kind of ate away at me. I didn't know what was happening. I'd like to share with you a comment on this. It was made by a non-alcoholic psychiatrist named Dr. Abraham Twersky, who practices in Pittsburgh. He's a wonderful man. Great, great guy. A great understanding of AA. And he wrote an article which was intended to tell other doctors how to specialize in the treatment of alcoholics, which is what Dr. Twersky does. He was saying in this article, he was commenting that they should be aware that alcoholic patients lie a lot. He said, as a matter of fact, you may be surprised that they are maybe the only people in the country who will pay $100 an hour to go to a psychiatrist and lie about why they're there. That's true. But he also said, and this is the part that really I related to, he said that in this article, he said that the best advice that he had ever gotten on this subject had come from a member of Alcoholics Anonymous very early in Dr. Twersky's practice, when he had been complaining to this AA about this. And the AA member had said, "Why, Doc," he said, "you can tell when an alcoholic is lying if you just know how to watch his lips." And Dr. Twersky said, "Oh, is that right? How's that?" And the AA member said, "If his lips are moving, he's lying." That comes from one of our non-alcoholic friends. How about that? I was also having a lot of trouble with the shakes and with tremors, you know, and with me they were more like the leaps, and I couldn't possibly have lifted up a glass, you know, and got it to my lips in those days. And God forbid that I would ever have to eat soup, for example, at a important business luncheon or something, you know. I would sit there absolutely paralyzed with fear as I looked down at the soup before me. Finally, I would get the spoon all right, and I'd get it into the soup, and I'd get it up about this far, and it would go like this, you know. So, you know, the alcoholic solution is to quit having soup. But that kind of fear really spread into a lot of different parts of my life. And then I discovered that if I had a belt of vodka before I started that lunch, as soon as I got that vodka, all this inside, I was shivering inside and outside, you know, and as soon as I got that, boy, I could just feel this peace coming all through my body and out to the ends of my fingers and my toes, and then, boy, I could lift up glasses, I could drink soup, I could sign my name. I could never do that before. I could answer phones, I could do all kinds of things like that. And so from that moment on, I was absolutely hooked on always being under the influence of alcohol. I could not function unless I had some alcohol in my system. See people nodding down here. Did you have that experience? And that in turn reminds me of a Grapevine article of about 3-4 years ago, maybe more now, that it was by somebody writing from down in Australia or New Zealand, but I thought they really had an insight because they said that when an alcoholic takes a drink in order to do some act that the normal person, you know, does naturally, like answer the phone or answer the door or, you know, make love or any of those things, when an alcoholic takes a drink to do that, he gives up forever and absolutely the possibility of doing that particular thing again without a drink. And that was exactly my experience. One morning on the way to work, I was falling apart. And so I had the recommended morning drink, my first one, I guess. And I never went to work again after that without a morning drink. Again, I'm indebted to the Grapevine for a one-liner when they said that when an alcoholic does something once, it's a habit. And I think that's really true. We are so obsessive and compulsive that it's just unbelievable. I was having an awful lot of trouble coping with other areas of my life. For example, I had a great deal of trouble dealing with any criticism. I couldn't stand being bawled out when I was in the Navy, and afterwards I didn't like to be criticized. I still have trouble this way, actually, but not nearly what I did then. Because, for example, being a writer, I had an editor. And the job of an editor is to criticize the writer's writing. Now, most writers accept this as a part of the job, and they don't have any trouble with it. But I had a great deal of trouble handling this. It really disturbed me that this really ignorant boob of an editor would have the nerve to fiddle around with my classic prose. You can relate to this, can't you, Carrie? But I did find that if I was going in to see my editor about a piece of copy, if I had a drink before I went in, I didn't much care what he did to it. And so that was the way, you see, that I was coping with life in every way. In fact, I want to, particularly because the family's here, I want to share with you an example of how I was coping with life, and that was when Betsy, Marty's parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary, and they chose to have it back in our part of the country. They came to our house to a gathering of the family, maybe 20, 30 people at that time. A lot of the people here were there. That morning, as I went into commuting from Connecticut, where we lived, into New York City to go to work, Betsy, I say never did this, but on this particular morning, she said, "Now, darling," she said, "you know how important this occasion is tonight." And she says, "I do hope that today you won't have too big a lunch." I knew what she meant, and she knew I knew, but you know what happened. I had a very big lunch indeed. No food, but a very big lunch otherwise. And I continued drinking in the afternoon, and I continued drinking on the bar car on the New Haven Railroad on the way home, and I'm afraid that when I got there, I was in very sorry shape. I stumbled down off of the train with my coat buttoned up crooked and my hat on the side of my head and in no shape. And poor Betsy, she was noticeably cool. Drove home, and the party was already underway, and everybody was on the patio out and back, and I went in the front door and, of course, made a beeline for the pantry where the bar was set up because I sure did need a drink. And had one, and I blacked out. I don't remember really what happened for maybe a half hour or more after that, maybe an hour after that. I sort of came to when they hauled me out from under the grand piano where I had taken refuge, clutching my drink to my breast because I had the feeling that they were going to take it away from me. And, of course, when they found me, that's exactly what they did. And they sent me to my room for the rest of the evening. Now, I was at this time 44 years old. And actually, my wonderful brother-in-law, Clyde, he's not here today, but of all the members of the family, he came up to the room and he tried to comfort me and he tried to say maybe I needed a change of job or a change of location, and he was really trying to help me. He was the sweetest, kindest thing. As Betsy said this morning, he was the only one that gave a damn. But anyhow, that was the way that I was coping with life generally, I guess, in those days. And so the progression had gone on, and I didn't look much like I didn't do now, because in those days I was much, much heavier, and I had a great big beer belly, pot belly, and a distended abdomen, and I had jowls, and I had broken blood vessels all in my face, and I had yellow eyeballs, and I was really a mess. And in this period, I became aware of a lump in my abdomen, and I felt it grow and grow, and I knew that this was curtains, and so I finally got up nerve to go to our family doctor, and he stretched me out, and he felt around a little bit, and then he asked me a question that some of you may have been asked at one time or another. He said, Bob, how much do you drink? And in that moment, I actually didn't lie to him. I sort of toted it up in my head, and I said, oh, 8 or 9 drinks a day. And, you know, he looked startled, and what I didn't tell him actually was that my drink of choice in those days was 100-proof vodka chased with Valentine's ale, which was, you know, a Russian boilermaker, you might say, and it really did it to you. And it was about 8 or 9 of those that I had, and he said, you don't mean every day? And I said, sure, every day. And he said, well, we may have a clue as to what your trouble is. And so he gave me a liver test, the liver function test, and of course it came out that my liver was badly, badly damaged, and of course that was what this was, a great swollen, lumpy liver. And he set me down, and he read me the riot act that a doctor should. He said, some people can drink and some people can't, and you're in the latter category. And he said, every time you look at a bottle, you should see on the label, because that's what it is to you. And he really threw the Spirit of God into me, and I left his office, and I went home, and for 10 months, I didn't drink. Now, he had not mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think he knew anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was doing it completely on my own, and it was a kind of a long recuperation. And I had to keep going back for tests all the time. And finally, at the end of 10 months, after a lot of treatment and things were going okay, I went back to his office one day for the usual stop, and he gave me a liver function test, and he sat me down in his office afterwards, and he said, you have made a remarkable recovery. He said, your liver has regenerated itself, and it's probably as well off as it's ever going to be. And he said, you don't need to come back anymore. So I guess subconsciously I had been looking forward to this moment. So at any rate, I said to him very casually, I said, well, John, does that mean then that on a hot summer's day when I've been out cutting the lawn maybe I could have a cold beer. And he looked a little troubled by that, and so I added, or a fine wine with dinner, which was a crock, as you know. I never had a fine wine with dinner, but he said to me the fatal words to the alcoholic. He said, "Well, Bob, one won't hurt you." So between the time that he said that to me and by the time I got home, which was maybe 10 minutes later, what he had said to me was translated into, "Guess what, Betsy? I can drink again." And of course she was overjoyed to hear that. But nevertheless, I jumped on the train and I went into town and I went down to the great oaken bar at the English Grill and I said, "Sam, set 'em up. We're in business again." And so he set up the vodka and the ale and I had it, and of course it didn't hurt me. And you know the story. I don't need to even tell you. It was maybe a week before I had another. And maybe, another week or two before I had another one or two. And then it was Christmas time, and I was going to Christmas parties. And, as rational people, you can't go and have just one drink at a Christmas party. So, I rationalized that you let the drink metabolize for about 45 minutes, and then to your body, the next drink is just like one drink. And, I went on a business trip, and at the end of that business trip, I had not intended to drink, and yet, at the end of that time, I was drinking just as desperately and alcoholically and crazily and insanely as I had been when I had first noticed the lump in my abdomen. And so there followed 2 years of really insane, terrible drinking. My liver got much worse, of course went into cirrhosis of the liver right away, and I had all kinds of bad physical things happen to me. I got so weak that I couldn't even turn on and off a faucet in our house that worked kind of hard. I got so weak I couldn't lift up my suitcases to go on business trips that I still had to go on all the time. I got spontaneous bruising all over my body. I became a bleeder. I had nosebleeds that you wouldn't believe. They just would not stop. I had to be taken out of my office on two different occasions, once by stretcher and once in a wheelchair, with a nosebleed. Can you imagine this? Took me down to the infirmary. They cauterize your nose. They stuff a lot of gauze up there, and they stuff a lot of cotton up there to the point that it makes it difficult to drink. But not that difficult, and I just never associated that kind of thing with drinking. And I did have these spontaneous bruises, great big green and purple and blue bruises all over my body. And partly it was due to the fact that at that time I was falling down a lot and I was running into furniture a lot. But it was also just sort of spontaneous bruising that happens because your whatever it is that causes your blood to coagulate, your liver stops making it and you just become a bleeder of this kind. I would wake up sometimes during this time, and Betsy was, of course, worried to death. My doctor was telling me I was going to die. I would wake up in the middle of the night, and we share a double bed, and Betsy would be weeping into the pillow next to me and wondering what in the world was going to happen to her and to the kids. And I would sit up in bed, and I would see these things in front of my eyes swimming around, whether I closed my eyes or opened them, and I knew I had to have a drink. But I couldn't get out of bed and get a drink because she was awake, and I was sad because I knew that she was so unhappy because of me. But with all of this, I just said, well, that's the way the ball bounces. I just could not. I had absolutely no choice about whether I drank or not. So, of course, I had to drink. Well, at the end of this period, I was on another business trip, and exactly what the doctor had been warning me about happened to me. And that is that out in Chicago, I had I had been carousing a lot for several days, and I had a massive esophageal hemorrhage. I lost about half the blood in my body in just a few hours, losing it rectally and vomiting it, and it was a terrible, terrible thing. And they took me out of the hotel, and at that time, actually, I had gone out in the park first to sort of, you know, throw up behind the bushes out there, and was kind of, in a way, taking an inventory, I guess. And it was a kind of a bleak October day in Chicago, and I sat there and I thought to myself, now it's just as well if I go ahead and die, because Betsy's young and pretty, and she won't have any trouble finding another man, and
he'll be a better husband to her than I've been, a better father to my children. And
I was just wallowing in this kind of self-pity garbage that the alcoholic gets into, you know. And then I think, no, here I am 1,300 miles from home, and I'm in Chicago, and who wants to die in Chicago, you know? And so I let the hotel call their house physician, and he was a tough bird. He came, and he knew exactly what was wrong with me, and boy, in minutes, the ambulance was there with the stretchers and the field kits of intravenous blood, you know, and they took me to a hospital. I didn't know what hospital I was in for several days. And at the end of a week or so, with many, many transfusions, I was feeling perky enough that they decided to send me on home. But, of course, before they did, they said, now, you know what you've been through, and if you ever take another drink, it may well be your last. And I said, don't worry. I have learned my lesson. Right? Yeah, right? Now, for about 2 months, I learned my lesson, because they had not told me about Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't know that it was the first drink that gets you drunk. I didn't know, as it tells you in the big book, that the first drink sets up this obsession and compulsion that dooms us to either go mad or to die if we are alcoholics. And so, I got back, we were going to a football game. Again, I ask you as rational people, did you ever hear of going to a football game without a drink? I hadn't. And so, I had a drink. And the compulsion was immediately set up, and within weeks, I was sicker than I had ever been before. And I had another massive esophageal hemorrhage. On this one, I was at the hospital at home, but it was worse in the middle of the night. In the middle of the first night, I know we have a nurse down here, in the middle of the first night, they ring a code 500 on me, which means the patient is dying. And it brings all the medical help and the nurses, and it brings the oxygen, and if you're a Catholic, it brings the priest for the last rites. I don't happen to be a Catholic, but I really had made my peace with my Maker that night. And yet I survived it. In the morning, and I really felt at that time, even as mocus as I was, that perhaps my higher power, although I didn't call him that in those days, was intervening in my life and sparing me for something. And I'd like to think, you know, that it's for exactly this kind of wonderful, wonderful weekend and this kind of life that we have now. But at any rate, at that time, after 2 or 3 days, they had, again, with a lot of other people's blood in me, they declared me ambulatory. And so I got up out of bed, and I pulled on my trousers and my shirt and my shoes, and I ambulated down about a block away to the liquor store and got a bottle of vodka and smuggled it back into the hospital, and I was sucking away on it when Betsy called me. Now, Betsy had an uncanny ability to know when I had been drinking from 75 miles away. And so she immediately after this called my doctor and squealed on me and said, Pierce is drinking. And he said, oh no, he's in the hospital. He can't be drinking. And she said, I know he is. So he came in absolutely disgusted. And he said, I can't be responsible for your life any longer. He said, I'm sending you to a psychiatrist. Well, you know, I knew I wasn't insane. But I was in no condition to argue. So he sent me to a psychiatrist. And here's where my higher power truly intervened in this alcoholic's life. Because he sent me to a psychiatrist who happened to practice in the same suite of offices as he did. That's the only reason he sent me to him. But the name of the man that he sent me to was Dr. Harry Thibault, the one professional in the world at that time who knew more about alcoholism than any other that Bill talks about so much in AA Comes of Age, who was at that time serving as a non-alcoholic trustee on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. But, of course, he didn't let me know that. He talked to me exactly twice. And the summation of that, as he told Betsy, actually, he said, I can't help your husband. He has an iron curtain drawn down between himself and reality. And I'm sure that some of you relate to that. It's just like Dr. Silkworth, in his opinion, in the big book. He says the alcoholic gets to the stage where he can't differentiate or can't distinguish between reality and fantasy. And he believes that alcoholic behavior is normal behavior. And that's exactly where I was at that stage in my life. And Dr. Thibault said to me, he said, I can't help you. But he said, see, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. He said, I can't help you. But he said, I know somebody who's had the same problem that you've had, and will you call him? And I said, no. And he said, if I call him, I said, no, I don't want to bother him. And Dr. Thibault gave me a little lesson in AA right then, because he leaned back and he chuckled a little and he said, these are very peculiar people. They don't consider that a bother at all. So he said, if I call him, will you speak to him? So, of course, I spoke to him, and the man who was to become my sponsor, I spoke to him then. And his name was Stu Jones, and he was a fabulous man. He was just what I needed. He happened to be the town attorney for the town of Greenwich, Connecticut. So he was a big shot, you know. So, like many of us, I could relate only to people on my social station. He also took me to my meetings in a Porsche sports car, which ain't too bad, you know, for starters. He wore a beret, and he had a great big guardsman's mustache, and he laughed a lot. He had a big, deep voice, and he just laughed a lot. He was a marvelous potter. He had a potter's wheel and made beautiful ceramic stuff, but he also had a black belt in karate. So, you know, he was a simply great man. And after my first meeting that he took me to, I remember he took me back and he said, well, what'd you think of it? And I said, oh, it was okay. He said, well, do you have any questions? And I said, yeah. I said, Stu, how in the world can you be so cheerful and so happy all the time when you know you're never going to have another drink? And he said, I haven't quit drinking for life. And I said, you haven't? And he said, no. He said, it's possible that I could drink tomorrow. He said, as a matter of fact, considering my record, people would say it's likely that I will be drinking tomorrow. But he said, I didn't drink today. And it was already at night, of course, by this time. And he said, that's the way we do it. Tomorrow's another day. I won't drink then either. So you see, little by little, he began to suck me into this philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to go to meetings, but I did not quit drinking. I was just too sick, my friends, too mocus, in too bad shape. And so at the end of about a week, which was really, in a way, as I look back on it, worst insane drinking. I don't even have time to tell you about that. But at the end of this week, it was the 3rd of July in 1961. And the little town of of old Greenwich, Connecticut was having its annual fireworks display. And our social life had deteriorated greatly during this time, as you can imagine. But on this particular night, we had agreed to meet some other people with their children and have a little family picnic in the backyard and then go down to this fireworks display. And the family picnic turned out to be a bonanza for me because the bar was set up in the kitchen. We were picnicking out in back. The bathroom was in the house, and of course I had to go through the kitchen to get to the bathroom, and so I was nipping each time that I went through, and I got steadily worse and worse. And we were late getting to the fireworks display. It was dark, and all the streets were just filled with parked cars and this little park around this little park. And so I took the family down there, and I let them off and said, I'll go park the car, which I did. And I went back down to this park, and of course the fireworks displays were going on, and I couldn't remember if, and I doubt it, but if we even made any arrangements to meet, but I sure couldn't remember if they did. And so I just started wandering around the park trying to find my family. And of course it was just wall-to-wall people with their families and their tablecloths and their picnic baskets and their perambulators and all of this kind of thing, which I was stumbling around over, hunting for my family. And then, boy, off would go this tremendous explosion up in the air, and the sparks would come down around me, you know, like this. And in that moment of light, I could look around, and I'd see these people looking up at me kind of angrily, you know, but no family. And then it would be dark, and I would go stumbling on, and boy, off would go this thing again, and the sparks would come down around me. And, it, you know, to me, it was like a scene out of Dante's Inferno. And then, boy, bam, 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 it goes, you know. It's the grand finale, and you know how that is, and the sparks come all around me. And the band strikes up America the Beautiful, and everybody gets up and folds their blankets and puts the kids in the perambulators, and they go home. And there I am. And I think to myself, as I'm standing in this empty park, I thought, I guess the family's gone to where the car's parked. And I thought, boy, that is stupid, because they don't know where the car's parked. And I thought, I don't know where the car's parked. So my solution was to trail off after the people who were leaving the park. And halfway up the hill, what you people had told me in the few meetings that I had gone to came home to me. It just struck me that my life was unmanageable. So I sat on a rock and cried. And it was there that Bessie's sister, not this one, but another one, found me, and she put her arms around me and said, there, there, and she led me back to the car, and sure enough, the family was there, they found it, and we went home, and in the kitchen, I've got to tell you this, because in the kitchen, when I got there, was a drinking buddy of mine that I hadn't seen in about a week, because I'd been going to these AA meetings, and he was sitting there at the kitchen table with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous spread out before him with another man that I didn't even know. You know what was going on? They had been down in the park. My friend Don had been down in the park, and he had seen me and saw what bad shape I was in. And so he had come to call. And it was your classic 12-step scene, except that he was drunker than I was. He had been coming to AA for about a week, like I had, and he was making his first 12-step call. The beautiful thing about that is that about 7 years later, he came in, and I was his sponsor. But anyway, the following morning, I came down, and there was Betsy. This was at our house, and I came down. There was Betsy with this doctor who had resigned me. And Betsy had been in touch with my employer. She had been in touch with our minister. She had been in touch with a lawyer and had commitment papers drawn up. And what was going on was a discussion of where I was to be committed. And that's what I stumbled in on. You know, that today they call these interventions, you know, but the interventions had not been invented in those days, except Betsy invented one. And as they were discussing whether to send me to the state nut house or the state hospital or a sanitarium or what, I opted from something I had heard in an AA meeting. I said, well, how about High Watch Farm, naming a treatment center, the great granddaddy of all treatment centers, up in Kent, Connecticut. It's described in AA Comes of Age, if you're interested. Beautiful spiritual place, hundreds of acres of beautiful scenery and a lovely old colonial farmhouse and spirituality that just comes out of every shingle, you know. I didn't know that then, of course. The reason I had chosen High Watch Farm was because they had a minimum 5-day staying period, and so I could get over the hill in a hurry and get back to my drinking. But that's where they ended up, threw me in. I, of course, was full of rage and hate and resentments and self-pity, and I told anybody who would listen that I didn't really belong there. I was a victim of a conspiracy, which was, of course, true. But somehow or other, during those days and 2 weeks that I was there, this iron curtain between me and reality began to crumble. And I began to relate to the people around me. And I tell you, it really took place mostly with my arms in the dishwater. You know, I would not have been caught dead doing dishes at home, but up there on the drunk farm, I was doing dishes and I was talking as sharing as we do to the people who were wielding the dishcloths, the drying cloths on the other end. And I begin to come out of this shell, this shriveled up little soul of mine begin to kind of open up. And I guess I begin to have the beginnings of a transforming spiritual experience, because at the end of the 2 weeks, I came back to Greenwich. I began to go to meetings. I became very enthusiastic and very involved right off. About 6 months after I was in, it just occurred to me that if I could go back to drinking with a magic pill that would make it possible for me to drink without ever causing any physical problems or any problems in relationships or job or anything, I realized I wouldn't be interested. Alcohol simply held nothing for me anymore. And that was no will of mine. That was my higher power having lifted this compulsion to drink that had driven me so far. And so it's been like that a day at a time ever since. And what the benefits that I have received from this fellowship and this program are beyond description. In my case, I think one of the greatest was the restoration to physical health. And I became a physical fitness nut. I'm a real bore on this subject. I'm an avid skier. I am an enthusiastic sailor. I run 2 to 5 miles every morning and have for the last 19 years. Running out here this morning over these windy hills with the sun just rising with the sky all pink, and it was just gorgeous. I do my 11th step every morning as I'm running. And I run through a litany of all of the blessings that God has given me in terms of health and family and job. Certainly my job for you, to the privilege of working for Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 12 and a half years, and doing what my heart is in, has been one of the greatest blessings that anybody can ever have. So I go through this litany, and I thank God for these blessings which I cannot possibly deserve. And that is the key, my friends, because that's the definition, isn't it, of God's grace, that we receive what we cannot possibly deserve. And yet we do. And it's just beautiful. And I think one of the great blessings that I've had is Betsy, of course, stuck with me through all this, with everybody telling her she should leave me, that I was going down the tubes, and she joined Al-Anon at the same time that I joined AA, and so she recovered along with my recovery, and although we always had a good marriage, it's put our marriage on a different spiritual base that has been absolutely beautiful for these last years. And my children, of course, who were pretty young and just going into the oldest one just going into his teen years when I came into AA, I was there for them when they needed me in their teen years. I was a father to them. And now there are, of course, many grandchildren, and what I love is that we hear them talking to their friends, not the grandchildren, but the children talking to their friends about troubles, marital troubles and financial troubles and moving troubles. And I hear them saying over the phone, well, you know, this too will pass, and it's just a day at a time, you know, and things that you just wonder where they got it. You know? Just wonderful. And of course, for me, the real blessing comes back to what that old timer said, and that is that I at least have a beginning on how to handle sobriety a day at a time. And the ways that we learn that are so myriad in AA. You know, we come in here with all this guilt and this remorse, and we're told that we got to get rid of that kind of garbage and replace it with positive thoughts. And we can get rid of the guilt and remorse by practicing the steps that we've heard about so much this weekend, particularly the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth. Cleaning house. And I was told, it was such a help to me when I first came in. They said that I should learn to differentiate between my wants and my needs. And boy, that really hit me, because I was the greatest wanter that the world ever produced. I drove a Mercedes at one time, but I was very discontented because I wanted a larger Mercedes. That was the way it was in my life, when my life was based on materialistic things. And they said when I came in here, they said, your wants will never be satisfied, because when you get one, it's replaced by another want. But your needs will always be provided by a loving God. You heard Julian say that last night. It's just so true. It's been our experience, certainly, for the last 15 or 20, 25 years. And we learn to, you know, live a day at a time. You know, this is a part of the world's religions, to live a day at a time. But we're the only people in the world, we in Al-Anon and AA, I think, who go to meetings every week and just talk about this and practice it all the time, living a day at a time. And we are, you know, granted the things in the serenity prayer, the courage to change the things that we can, to accept the things that we cannot change. And this has made it so different in my life, in accepting criticism and that kind of thing. And so, as was said, I just echo what a previous speaker has said. And that is that, well, first of all, that this reality that I ran away from all of my drinking life, and really long before that, from the time that I was, 5 years old, I was running away from reality. And lo and behold, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we discover that this reality is absolutely beautiful. And this reality exists only this very moment, this heartbeat, this breath, because the one that's past, you can't ever do anything about that. And the heartbeat that's ahead, it may be there and it may not. So really, all that you got is this very moment. And this very moment, you know, this morning in this beautiful place, all you beautiful people, has to be just one of the most beautiful realities that I personally can picture. And as one of the other speakers said, I think it's basically because we are finally at peace. Remember what he said? He said that we're at peace with ourselves and with our fellow man and with God.